An inside look at a turbulent war zone, getting to know a country through its food.
This is the Fertile Crescent. The oldest written recipes in the world are from southern Iraq.
Plus, tips for boomers heading into their next chapter, and an update from a New Yorker in Juneau. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Anya Sazadlo went to Iraq with her husband, who was there to cover the war. For 3 years, she learned about the culture her own way, through the local food. She compiled what she learned in the book Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. She spoke with 51%'s Katie Britton about what she learned from the cuisine of the Middle East.
What we hear on the radio, see on TV, and read in the newspapers is just a fraction of what life is like in Iraq. Anya Sazadlo has lived there and experienced the day-to-day life as both a journalist and a resident. As she explored her surroundings, she found that there was one thing that people from all religious backgrounds agreed upon, and that was food. Sazadlo wrote about her experiences in Iraq, not only with food, but with the war and its people in her memoir, Day of Honey.
It was an idea that had been brewing, no pun intended, for quite some time, simply because I tend to always look at food when I go to a new place. And so when I had gone to Baghdad, I always asked people about food, and I always pursued food as a way of trying to understand more about the city and about the country. And this sort of anthropological view of food was something that I'd always been aware of and had always had. I think mostly because my mom is a feminist, really. There's a number of reasons for the interest in food. As I write in the book, I'm always hungry. But mostly because my mom had raised me to be aware of food and to respect food and the people who make it, which is not always women, but often is. And, you know, depending on where you are and who you're hanging out with. So when I got to Baghdad, I always sought out food and makers of food, and I would always try to introduce it into whatever conversations I was having, particularly because it tended to break the ice. And then later on, when I was in Beirut, it suddenly hit me one day. I remember I was actually standing at the kitchen sink washing dishes, and I had these piles of greens all over the kitchen, like wild oregano and mint and lettuce and stuff like that. And it hit me, there had been quite a lot in the news about Lebanon lately because they had had this peaceful uprising, similar in some ways to the ones that we're having now in the Middle East. And then that got a lot of coverage, and then they'd had an election, and that got a lot of coverage. But in all this coverage, it tended to focus on strife and conflict for the most part. And it hit me, like, wow, why don't we see this side of Lebanon or of the Middle East as a whole? Why don't we see this side that's verdant and lush and generous and that has to do with everyday life and everyday people? People who aren't necessarily making headlines, but who make up the essential life of the country.
So what we see on the news every night, to me, it's what Americans have become almost immune to, the stories of Al-Qaeda, the soldiers bombarding homes and businesses, and men with beards carrying machine guns. It's just a fraction of what the people of Iraq are going through. Can you tell us about your first experience there?
You often have this experience of people coming up to you and offering you liquid first thing. If it's cold, maybe a cup of tea. If it's hot, maybe a tall, freezing cold glass of water. And it was an interesting thing because I learned very, very quickly, mostly through this, what I found out later was an ancient tradition of, you know, always offering water to guests who wander in out of the desert. I learned very quickly not to ever, ever turn it down. And this could be a problem sometimes. I remember once it was really, really hot, and I had just gotten over this really, really, really terrible case of dysentery, food poisoning, whatever. And this woman offered me this tall, kind of cloudy, almost milky-looking water that was certainly not probably anything that I should have been drinking in my state. But you have to drink it. You can't say no, oh, sorry. You know?
It would be rude.
It would be beyond rude. And so whatever it is, you got to just kind of suck it down.
From our perspective, all we hear is female persecution in the Muslim world and the deplorable rights of females. But as I'm reading, you don't get that sense, at least when you first get to Iraq before the insurgents come and really start making it more dangerous for women to be walking the streets alone.
That persecution is absolutely present, and I don't want to give the impression that it's not. It's just that we tend to only hear about that and not to hear about the other, which is women who are trying to make their way and women who are trying to make a difference. Iraq is one of the countries, in the Arab world that had a very high proportion of women in the workplace. And that's for a number of reasons. Saddam often gets credit for the position of Iraqi women in public life. He doesn't deserve it. A lot of those changes had happened under the monarchy and under previous governments. But there was still something of a remnant of that. You had a very high proportion of women working. You had a lot of women in relatively high-profile positions compared to other countries in the Arab world. Iraq was the first country to have a female member of parliament, and it was the first country to have a female minister back in 1959. And it was the first country, I believe it was the first country in the Arab world, also to have civil personal status laws, which is basically means that things like marriage, divorce, child custody actually come under civil law and not under religious law.
You never hear about that.
Well, it's not the case anymore, which is why you don't hear about it so much. Unfortunately, this is one of the real downsides to the war. And this is something that I feel has not been as well covered in the news media as I would have liked to see, because we've been focusing on militants and war and bombings and these sort of larger politics. But hey, this is more than half of the Iraqi population had this tremendous blow to, you know, to their autonomy. And interestingly enough, some of them were fine with it. For some of them, this was this, you know, part of this Islamic identity that they wanted to embrace. But very rarely have I seen anyone exploring the contradictions of that, because it's, for the most part, not considered an important topic. I consider it to be a very important topic.
Speaking from a journalist's point of view, those seem to be the stories that you would want to hear about instead of having the stories to get lost in the sauce of the constant bombardment and the bombing and the soldiers going in there, but of the real Iraqi people and how their lives have been affected.
I have to say, I was incredibly lucky to be working for the Christian Science Monitor and for most of the time that I was in Baghdad, because they were really, really good about pursuing those kinds of stories. I mean, they do the larger politics and the bombings and things like this, but they let me do stories about all kinds of things. They let me do stories about the disappearance of Christians from Iraq. They let me do stories about Iraqi weddings, Iraq's first reality TV show. And often stories like that can be very humanizing to American readers, because a bombing story will always kind of read very similarly to other stories about bombings usually. But Iraq's first reality TV show was a way for me to talk about houses being bombed and then rebuilt in a way that was unfamiliar and yet very familiar to American readers. Food serves the same function. Because look, this is where agriculture and civilization as we know it began. This is the Fertile Crescent. It's got to have good food. And it's also where the oldest written recipes in the world are from southern Iraq that we know of. And so the idea that it wouldn't have good food was just seemed preposterous. So I started asking around, and what I discovered is that there's this tremendous dichotomy between what foreigners were eating, which was mostly restaurant food, and mostly restaurant food, interestingly enough, that was not native to Iraq. A lot of it was Levantine food, like hummus and tabbouleh and things like that, which is very much of the Eastern Mediterranean and not very much native to Iraq. This was interesting to me, just to find out that hummus was something that was relatively new to Iraq. It's not an olive oil culture. It's more of a sesame oil and an animal fat cookery tradition in Iraq. And so I discovered all kinds of interesting things on this quest to find the good food in Iraq. And one of the things that I discovered was that the home cooking is fantastic. There's a whole universe of stews, and mostly vegetable-based stews, that people eat at home, poured over rice, that are amazing. And if your listeners are curious, there's a wonderful book of Iraqi cuisine called Delights from the Garden of Eden by a woman named Nawal Nasrallah. And she's got a lot of these stews in the book. Everything from lamb stew with tomato and apricots to turnip and Swiss chard with these dumplings that I can't describe but that are so good. I mean, she's got a lot of really amazing Iraqi home cooking in that cookbook. And that was the food that I discovered. And I realized that most of the other foreigners in Iraq were not actually having that food. And so they were just eating in hotels and restaurants and places like that, and consequently eating food that wasn't really that great.
Again, the name of Anya Szadlo's book is Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. It is published by Free Press. I'm Katie Britton.
Coming up, a life coach for boomers preparing for their next act, and an update from Susan Dyer on liars, fiddlers, and tourists in Juneau, Alaska. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1195. It is something all women eventually face, that transition from youth to maturity, from motherhood to empty nester, from career woman to the search for something more. This week's Alive and Kicking segment with Dr. Sharon Ufberg features a woman who specializes in helping boomer women prepare for their next act.
This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Alive and Kicking. Women of the baby boomer generation are coming out in huge numbers looking for their unique talents, looking for their passion, and trying to design their lives for ultimate meaning, fulfillment, and joy. Where do they go to find this? Well, one woman who sees a lot of them is Carol Lorraine. Carol is an inspired and highly creative boomer coach. She is an artist and a teacher, and as a transformational life coach, she offers breakthrough coaching for boomers who are really looking to cultivate their new talents and passion. Thanks for being with me today, Carol.
Thank you, Sharon.
It's wonderful to have you here. I know of your work and what an extraordinary life you're helping to create for women. Could you tell me what you see as the biggest fear or challenge that women face when they come to you stuck and not feeling the passion in their lives anymore?
What I find is that most women are afraid of making that commitment to themselves, to spending the time and their resources. They're so used to giving to other people.
Ah, I see. So when they're now looking at having more meaning in their lives, the first thing they need to do is say, I'm first, I come first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They've come to a time when most their children have left, they're starting their own lives, and it's time for them now. Some of them are a little bit afraid that they might not have a passion, that they might not know what it is after the careers that they've already had or having the families. So it's about really taking the time to tune into their own hearts, into their own souls. What is their vision for this next time in their lives?
And how do you get them to do that kind of visioning? Describe what you might do with them.
Well, the first thing is to allow themselves to ask themselves, what if time and money were not an object? What would my life be like? Let them visualize the ideal life, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Let them just explore what their life could be like. What are the possibilities? Looking at the possibilities.
And what ways do you do that? Describe how you, if someone called you, how would you help them? What would you be asking the woman to do?
Well, the first thing is to answer a series of discovery questions. So we work with these discovery questions, like I just started telling you one of them, a series of those questions. Or I might have them do a mental imagery exercise. It's a visualization where they visualize. I guide them and they visualize that perfect life, that ideal life, that passionate life with meaning. People are looking for meaning at this time in life. They want to bring their expertise, their life experience, and their gifts. They want to contribute
Definitely. And I think women from the baby boomer generation has so much to offer. And I find them incredibly inspiring and visionary. Because as an artist, you do a lot. You bring a lot of art into your creativity work, right?
I do.
Like mandala making. And I just love the idea of painting. That sounds like a wonderful retreat.
Well, you know, when have you last painted, Sharon?
You mean my bedroom?
Yes. When have you had the time to just pick up some paints and a brush and have fun? Letting yourself just, you know, it's like freeing your creative energies, freeing your creative spirit. So painting, drawing, movement, listening to music, those kinds of things really open people's inspiration.
So tell us how they could reach you. What's the name of your website?
It's called alivewithcreating.com. So if they'd like to get on my mailing list, I have a very inspiring newsletter that comes out. They can go to my website and sign up for that.
Alivewithcreating.com. Thank you so much, Carol Lorraine. Wonderful to have you with us today. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Alive and Kicking.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is an integrative healthcare practitioner who hosts a regular Alive and Kicking segment here on 51%. She's also featured on KVON, KVYN, The Vine in Napa Valley, and writes for Women's E! News.
Oh, I wish I were a real Alaskan girl. I wish that I could hold my beer. I could wear hip waders in summer and heels at 10 below. I'd have sexy woolly legs with long and flowing frozen hair.
Finally, we met Susan Dyer when she first left her job as a writer in Rochester to take a teaching job in Juneau, Alaska. She was drawn by the adventure, by the newness, by the unknown. She's since added the job of radio show host to her resume, made a new circle of friends, and survived her first Alaskan winter. When she filed this report about a month ago, she was preparing for the tourist season.
It's been very busy here in Juneau. As the season for cruise ships begins, float planes and helicopters flying in pairs will be landing and taking off hour after hour, carrying foreigners and lower 48 folks across Gastineau Channel to nearby ice fields and back. That must be why Alaska's Folk Festival happened 2 weeks ago. It was 7 days of singing, fiddling, trombone, and piano playing, and it was all free and open to the public. Yes, that's right, it was free, and it was some of the best music this former New Yorker had ever heard. The stage performances were great, but the improvisational gatherings of musicians in the hallway were the best. One musician played for a bit, then stood up and left just as another sat down. I stood for hours listening and was never pushed or shoved. Remember, I'm in Alaska, not Boston or New York. A crowd here is a dozen or so people. Workshops for songwriting and folk dancing were held during the day. And there were some workshops that, well, I can only say, I'm glad I walked into town to catch a few of those unique venues. My favorite was the Lyres and Fiddlers Consortium at the Alaska Museum. I sat down just in time to catch a well-known local woman named Colette tell what I thought was claimed to be a lie. But when her story ended, she declared it was all the truth and dared anyone to say otherwise. I slowly raised my hand and asked the innocent enough question, "What does fiddling and lying have in common?" It was as if I was asking what God had to do with the Bible. The leader of the consortium looked at me and answered, "They're offspring of the same use. The fiddling provides breathing space for the lies to ferment." Another attendee spoke up and said, "Fiddling and lying. Well, I confess, it is a bit redundant." I sat and listened as others stood up and told their tales. It was open mic for liars, but there were no politicians in attendance. On the last day of the festival, I was at the mic. I was the DJ broadcasting the folk festival live on Juneau's local NPR station, KRNN. It was the best seat in the house. Walking home a few days later, I came to a complete halt as I saw an absolutely huge bud jutting out from the soil in a neighbor's backyard. These were the first buds of spring, yet they weren't the tiny purple heads of crocuses that pepper gardens back east. No, these were the yellow buds of skunk cabbage, and they were the size of donkey ears. That moment, standing there on the sidewalk, listening to eagles overhead, I truly came to realize that there is nothing small here in Alaska. And what about that name, skunk cabbage? I'm sure there's a scent that will rise up from those yellow donkey-sized buds that will put the stench of pricey cheese to the test. I'll have to chase down one of those French cruise boat tourists and ask them to sniff and compare. Cruise boats aren't the only vessels operating on the Alaskan waters. The Maritime Ferry System will also be fully operating next week. It runs in the winter, but with fewer boats and a limited schedule. Working on the ferry is a lifestyle in itself. The crews work 1 week on and 1 week off. The week they are on, the crews work 84 hours. There's a name for husbands and wives left ashore, ferry widows or widowers. Many of the crew just work one summer to have their Alaskan experience. They will leave to go down south before the termination dust falls. For non-Alaskans, that is the first snowfall of the year, signaling the slowly darkening days. These days, though, it's light till almost 9, and it'll soon will be light until 2 or 3 in the morning. When I arrived here, I was told the winters would be the hardest, but I find 20 hours of sunlight a little challenging myself. Maybe it's those long hours of sunlight that make everything grow so much larger here. Last summer, I was sitting outside around midnight drinking an Alaskan IPA when all of a sudden I saw an eagle tugging at the rim of the sun. I guess it craved darkness just as much as me. Its wings were flapping and feathers were dropping here and there. It tugged in the sun until finally it dipped down to the horizon for just a second before bouncing back in the middle of the sky. I thought maybe I had one too many beers, but when I checked my six-pack, only a single bottle had been emptied. A moment later, that same eagle landed on my porch rail. Its head was no longer white, but singed black like the rest of its body and beak. That eagle had become a raven. It crooked its head, looked me in the eye, and cawed. So I leaned forward and kissed that raven right on its beak, and in the flash of a moment, it turned back into the most beautiful eagle I've ever seen. Now that's the truth and the whole truth. Come to Juneau and say it ain't so, and I'll buy you a drink at the Red Dog Saloon, and you can smell the scent of skunk cabbage on a full moon. Yes, the moon does rise here in Alaska. For 51%, this is Susan Dyer.
Oh, Alaskan girls are fearsome and fearless by design. They kill mosquitoes with a look and mess with trusting tourist minds. They're ruggedly handsome in their way. They're wild and free and meant to be that way. So from Jackaloff to Juneau, raise a glass to a proud and confident and deserving Alaskan woman, you know. And from Beaver to Tatibla.
Susan Dyer is a writer and radio show host. She lives in Juneau, Alaska. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.